Tell me about the program, the Environmental and Climate Justice Program. How long has that existed?
For 7 years.
So you brought it to life.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was the impetus at that particular time, Jackie?
Interestingly enough, it was a combination of our then president and CEO, Vangelis, was part of this group called the Commission to Engage African Americans on Climate Change. And the other commissioners were from think tanks or from universities. The NAACP was the only base building organization, and the commission and its funders determined that in order to engage African Americans on climate change, it can't be just them sitting in a think tank thinking about strategies. They have to actually have access to the people, and the NAACP, being an organization with 500,000 members and 2,200 branches and chapters, became kind of the legs for their mission. And so we got a supplemental grant to start the program, to start to do outreach to African Americans around issues of climate change at that point.
Here in Milwaukee, we topped the list in some unfortunate areas. Segregation is a huge issue, has been decades, decades, decades. So how do you piece together where environmental justice, climate change justice, fit within that unfortunate framework? And I read one thing on your homepage: race is the number one indicator for placement of toxic facilities in the country. I mean, that hits you right between the eyes, doesn't it?
Yes. So it's interesting in terms of how historical divisions have contributed to where we are, and then how also that climate change and environmental justice becomes a threat multiplier for those things. So, for example, looking at historical segregation, the fact that communities are disproportionately impacted by toxic facilities, whether it's coal plants or incinerators or landfills, communities of color are more likely, African-American communities making $50,000 a year are more likely to have a toxic facility next to them than a white American family making $15,000 a year, according to the research by Dr. Bob Bullard, who's now at Texas Southern University. And we know that kind of place of home, the segregation around that is deepened by the fact that people don't want to live next to those toxic facilities. Those toxic facilities come into those communities because of the lack of political power that often happens with those communities. And then it's perpetuated as property values are lower, and on average, if you're living next to a toxic facility, you're on average, your property values are 15% lower than other communities. And then that leads to other things as well, because if your property values are lower, we know property values are what finances some of our infrastructure, for example, schools. And so kids are in under-resourced schools, and then they have less in the way of other resources in the community. Those communities are disproportionately food insecure. So you have kids who aren't getting the proper nutrition, who are under-resourced schools. They're next to these toxic facilities, so they're breathing in toxins that contribute to their ability to pay attention in school, or contribute to their ability to go to school if they're asthmatic. And you have communities that are constantly having poor air quality days, because 71% of African Americans live in counties in violation of air pollution standards, of federal air pollution standards. So when you have all of that combined, you see how that the ability to be able to have educational attainment. And then for us, we also tie it to even our work around criminal justice, because studies show that if you're not on the grade level by the third grade, you're more likely to enter into the school prison pipeline. And so those very communities are the ones that are over-policed, that tend to have these situations of racial profiling, that tend to have more situations of police brutality, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that just connects. And you talk about the term sacrifice zones, where these types of communities, where they are host to the waste facilities, because and they become sacrificed to our overconsumption, where we're producing so much and we don't even have enough places to put all of that waste. It goes into these communities. We're sacrificed to our use of energy, where 80% of the energy that's generated is actually wasted. But the fact that we use so much energy in the first place And 78% of African Americans, for example, are within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant. And so our health and well-being is sacrificed as mercury, arsenic, lead, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide comes out of those smokestacks. So I think I've illustrated some of those connections.
Yeah. So do you think we're also hitting a time period in which a lot of forces and a lot of, climate change is becoming more and more obvious? Lead pipes, such a politically charged cycle that our country has gone through, that many people are still trying to figure out what to do, where and where they fit in. Do you think that in some ways is an asset in just saying, okay, there's no going back now, we have to look hard here?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. I think that there's been a role too of media and social media that has helped people to actually see these various issues and understand these issues in a way that they didn't before. Now that the collective of storytellers has become more broadened, and the way stories have been told in the past, the story of climate change, the story of the economy and so forth, have all been kind of slanted in a certain direction that hasn't been accessible to the broader swath of society. And now that we have new storytellers who can really make these issues accessible, I think we're seeing a tide, a shifting tide in the political climate and otherwise as a result, in good and bad ways, probably.
So in your day-to-day, Jackie, what keeps you going? The problem or the steps towards the solution?
Both, really. I mean, when I first started to get involved around issues of disasters and climate change, it was out of doing relief work after Hurricane Katrina. And so just seeing that, knowing that that could have been avoided in some ways, not only in terms of the actual disaster itself, but also in terms of how people were being impacted, and the vulnerabilities that were underlying their disproportionate impact. So those kind of things certainly drive me, and then I'm motivated by seeing folks who are on the other side. So like, I see the worst in terms of communities that I go to that are, in kind of devastating situations, and then I see the best in terms of, now that I've been doing this for 7 years, I've seen the communities that have evolved over time through organizing and through, visioning and organizing and implementing. I've seen what it looks like on the other side once they, once they start to get to where they want to go. And so that motivates me, and then I'm driven by the folks who still need to get there.